All of the views and opinions expressed here are those of the individual speaking and may not be representative of Coding American. At times, language may be considered vulgar. Listener discretion is suggested.
You are now listening to the Coding Behind the Wheel podcast.
All right, welcome to a special episode of the Behind the Wheel podcast. I'm Scott, I'm the marketing director for Koenig Wheels. With me is Joey Redman. Joey's the founder of Wrecked Magazine and has been published in over 20 automotive magazines. Additionally, he has built SEMA vehicles for OEs like Hyundai and Ford. Finally, you can find his 10 Things Learned article available on formuladrift.com after each FD event. In case you're new to the podcast, Joey and I get together after each FD round. We briefly run through some thoughts and highlights from the event. This is in addition to our regular podcast format, so make sure to look for the next one, which will be after round 7 in Texas. So for St. Louis, this was the first time we were at Gateway. There was a lot of learning that happened here for drivers and teams. This is the longest and fastest track that I think FD has in their schedule, right?
I don't know if it's the longest.
I think it is. I think I went and actually did a little research because I heard somebody say that. I think Chris Forsberg actually said that in an interview. He said, this is the longest track that we have. And I went and looked and I was like, oh, you know what? It may be.
Really? I feel like Irwindale's bound to be longer, but maybe that's just my own.
Yeah, you know, maybe he's just saying bias. Like maybe it's the longest of the faster tracks. I'm not really sure.
But I mean, he probably knows more than I do. I mean, it's definitely like the longest turn, I guess you could say. That last decreasing radius turn. Yeah, it's basically just like a larger version of Texas Motor Speedway, right? At that part.
Right.
To me, the length isn't necessarily what's so crazy about Gateway. I think it's the speed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really translate on the live stream because they use those really high camera angles.
Yeah, it's hard to tell from the camera.
But I mean, you're talking, they're going 3 times the speed of Long Beach, basically.
Right.
I mean, when you think about that in perspective, like imagine any speed in a vehicle times 3, right? Like even the different, you know, imagine the difference in your reactions if you're going 35 on everyday, you know, imagine like you going 35 on the interstate.
Right.
And then imagine you going, 100 on like a side street.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's like the gap of 3 times. And so, I mean, I think there are a lot of drivers that probably aren't used to drifting that fast. I mean, obviously you're a professional and you know, you get in where you fit in, but there's not a lot of triple digit drifting going on, I think, anywhere in the world.
Right. Yeah. I think this track had a lot of technical pieces to it. It really seemed, if you would watch a lot of the drivers, if you stumbled off your line early on in the course, it made it kind of tough to recover your line and get back on and be able to finish off with any given success. We saw that with a number of drivers. So, I don't know. I mean, I think Gateway brought with it a lot of excitement. I thought it was a really good event. I thought that this was probably the most exciting event that I've seen in a while.
Yeah, I think me too. I mean, I'm maybe a little more familiar than Gateway with most, like the old event series.
Right.
I helped run Street Driven. We did Gateway every single year.
Right.
My first experience with Gateway, I think, was even like Nopi Drift back in like 2006.
It was the same. Did you guys use in Street Driven event, did you use the same course configuration or was it slightly different?
Street Driven is an identical course layout to the Formula D course.
Okay.
So, I mean, honestly, there's not really, I can't even really take credit for it. I think Midwest Drift Union, which they're not around anymore either, but right. the Midwest Pro-Am series also ran that configuration. And I think Drift STL, the few times they do the road course, they run that configuration. It's not that it's like everyone's playing off everyone. There's not really another way to run the course.
Okay.
The way the road course is configured, it's kind of complicated. It uses part of the NASCAR track, which they won't allow you to drift on the NASCAR track. So right. That kind of eliminates like a large part of the road course. And I think some guys have explored running it in reverse. And from what I understand, you know, I kind of lack some of that super technical knowledge, but like it just doesn't really work with like that kink where you kind of start out. Like it's really funky to go mm-hmm. across the, because you have to go across the berms, right? So when you're going across the berms in reverse, it doesn't work as well.
Right. What I thought was interesting about St. Louis was It seemed like that last outer clipping zone, with the one with the, you know, the big sweep. It seemed like so many drivers, whether you're watching Pro 2 or you're watching qualifying, maybe this was just having been there before, kind of getting used to the line, maybe not having enough speed generated but by the time you got to the outer part. But the issue to me was that it didn't seem about horsepower or not, but if you didn't have enough speed, you just couldn't get the car to, you know, to obviously stay in drift to that well outer zone. And I know that Ryan, one of the FD judges, was basically kind of making a point to the drivers in the drivers meeting that is part of the course that they're really going to be looking at, the making sure that you get all the way to that outer zone. Like, they don't want to see you, you know, shorting up or shallowing up that line and then coming into that last clip. So, but it seemed like that was a big issue. And then there was that risk reward where some of the guys got really overzealous, came in with a little bit too much speed, and once you touched that grass, which was basically like hitting glass, once you went off the course, especially in qualifying, because they had like pretty epic rainstorm. So I don't know how wet the grass really was, but it seemed like especially in qualifying, especially in Pro 2 qualifying, when you touched off course, especially in that outer zone there, you really went for a ride and it was lights out.
It did seem that way. I miss Pro 2 qualifying specifically. I did hear that from a couple guys. It definitely did not seem like, I think really it was a mixture of two things. I think when the Pro 2 guys did qualifying, it was still really, really wet.
Right.
And so I think then what happened is when the Pro 2 guys went off course, they really rutted the track up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so I think by the time the Pro guys and Pro 2 competition got there, there was basically no margin. Like, you were basically just, you know, like going from like track to ground. Like, there wasn't like a smooth, like, oh, I'm just going to pop into the grass here real quick. It was really like upsetting the car and throwing the car off. But, you know, I mean, that's just one of the things that comes with being on a real racetrack, right? Like, if you look at Road Atlanta, there's not much forgiveness there with, like, the pea gravel, right, yeah, on the one side.
And, sure.
You know, you got to take the good with the bad. I will say, when two drivers were drifting that course correctly, it was some of the best drifting ever. Like,
right.
I think I mentioned in the top 10, like, Dean Kearney's chase run in, like, top 32 with Pitior, like, they both hit that clip. They both ran that outside line like really close together and really well. It was just really entertaining. Like, Vaughn versus James Dean, I think in top 16 was another one that was like, when two guys could put it together, it was like, wow, this is really close door-to-door drifting, but also really high speed, which I think is something, you know, it's nice to see like different variables being brought into Formula Drift.
Right. So I think that kind of covers your point 10, which you kind of summed up as gateway is great. I mean, you, I think, in kind of summary of what we just kind of said, Gateway was a really good event. It was a change of pace, maybe coming off the last six rounds. So I think you would agree that this was an event that we hope stays in their schedule for years to come.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I haven't really talked to anyone from Formula D since that event, whether they consider it a success or a failure.
Right. I'm sure the gate has a lot to do with that. So,
yeah, exactly. I, you know, honestly, when we were doing our events there, it was one of our lower gate attendances, but we kind of wanted to stay in the Midwest. You know, that might be a motivation for Formula D as well, just to kind of check that box. They've been very coast focused and it seems like they've been trying to fix that. I mean, they added Texas, which I do know from talking to the guys at Formula D, like, Texas has grown year over year.
Right.
So I imagine they'll probably put like a 3-year investment into Gateway and see what they can turn it into.
Right.
St. Louis isn't the greatest metropolitan city nationwide, but you know, if you can do well, you can pull down from Chicago, which I think is 4 or 5 hours. Kansas City's 4 or 5 hours.
So right.
There's some potential there. There's probably some better tracks geographically in the Midwest, but I think from like quality of the venue, I think that's probably the best the Midwest can offer, like in like a city environment.
Yeah, and then they're a real, I want to say racetrack. It sounds ridiculous, but they hold really big events. I mean, they're, like you said, they're a NASCAR track. This isn't a mom and pop type track. So,
and honestly, I don't have a problem with mom and pop tracks.
No, of course not.
I think the issue that I see with Formula D is I don't want to see any more ovals.
Right. Yeah, we've done it.
I don't mind the ones that are on the cards, really. I could live without Wall. I mean, it is what it is. But I don't want more than half the series being ovals. Like, it's, you know, at the end of the day, there's plenty of ovals I think they could go to all around the Midwest. But at the end of the day, I think it's nice to see
some of the road courses mixed in.
Yeah, more than anything, I like variety. I don't want to get rid of the ovals. But it's like, I don't want to only be ovals. I like that Long Beach is kind of like, I mean, a road course. It's really like a, you know, kind street, of a parking lot setup. Yes, right. Of course. Yeah. It does use a little part of a real street. And, you know, I think the variety keeps the competition level high. Like, there are guys that have clear skill sets. There's guys that do really well at these road courses, like a Kenguchi. Kenguchi can dominate these road courses, and then he can't figure out how to drift on a oval to save his life.
That's tough.
That's what separates the men from the boys. I mean, if you look at NASCAR, I think it's the same way. There's guys that are really good at the half-mile tracks. There's guys that are really good at the two-and-a-half, you know, the super speedways.
Right.
There's guys that are good at the mile ovals in between. There's a few guys that are really good at the road courses. So I just think for you to be considered like a world championship or like
you should see a mix of courses and different terrain and stuff like that.
Exactly. I want to see your skill set across a multitude of different, you know, environments.
And I think FD's done a good job about trying to – I think they're extremely conscious and aware of that. I believe that they're trying to do – as much diversification as they can within their schedule. I mean, obviously there's a great logistical part that goes into trying to find these venues and plan these venues and bring the amount of resources and staff and amenities to each venue that they go to. So there's a lot of behind the scenes there, but I believe that they've done a very good job about trying to balance out the amount of looks and track styles that they get.
Totally.
So your point number 9, which is one of my favorites because it's talking about Travis Reeder. Travis Reeder is better than some of the pro circuit drivers, is your point number 9. Look, Travis is incredibly talented. I think I've been saying it since we started doing these, and I've had a good behind the scenes working experience with Travis. He's a good all-around dude and an extremely talented driver. And I even said, you know, after last year when he was second place in Pro 2, that this was a guy that had the skill set to make the move. And really what Travis's, you know, inability to make the move had to do everything with budgeting. There's just not enough money that he could pull in to be able to make the jump up to Pro. So you kind of are pointing out that he's definitely better than a good handful of drivers that are in Pro right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not going to, like, name any names.
Of course.
But I mean, if you take maybe the bottom ranked 5 or 6 guys in Pro,
right?
I think Reeder could probably beat them 9 times out of 10, maybe 8 times out of 10. I don't know. I think I'm always just in general really tough on the Pro 2 kids because I think so many times you just see that, you know, you see that like you got a guy in Pro 2 who's maybe got a little bit more budget or a little bit better of a car or a little bit better of a mechanic. He shows up, he beats up on everybody, and then he goes into Pro and kind of disappears into the ether. I think Reeder grabbed my attention originally by not going into Pro. I liked the fact that he stayed in Pro 2. He was like this close to being champion. Right?
Really
like,
was.
This close. And, you know, I don't know. I like the fact that he stuck around. I think I pointed out in my article, if he can win one more event, either Texas or Irwindale, he's already poised to be tied as the most winning Pro 2 driver in history. So,
right.
I mean, obviously there's not a ton of history in Pro 2, but like, to me, I think it would be, you know, if he doesn't have the budget, I just stay in Pro 2. And honestly, there's a larger conversation I've been involved in. I don't want to get too off the rails here, but I think they should work on rebranding Pro 2. They're kind of getting there already, but like rebranding Pro 2 a little bit to encourage other drivers to drive in it. Like, you know, I don't think it should be implied that it's such a feeder series. I think there should be some encouragement to get some of these lower tier pro guys to drive in it. Like, once again, using the example, I know where it's like sounding like a NASCAR heavy podcast here, but like, look at the Nationwide series, right? You have, you know, the Bush brothers driving in there. You have a lot of different guys who are doing both. And it's like, I think it would only help Pro 2 if you could get some of these guys who, you know, I don't think we expect to see Von Gitt Jr. say show up in Pro 2, but like, I think it would be great if like a guy like Jeff Jones and Kyle Mohan, some of the, they're like really poised veterans, but they're not, you know, through budget or whatever means, they don't quite have that top tier program where like they can kind of compete. So then I think it's also like, it's helping a guy like Travis Reeder, like know where he needs to be in pro.
Right.
But I think like, you know, a guy I think is a perfect example is like Pat Gooden, you know, for whatever reason, he didn't have his funding or anymore. Like he kind of like disappeared from the sport. But I think it's like too much of like a, I don't want to speak for Pat specifically, but I think for a lot of these guys, it's kind of like an ego blow to be like, oh, I'm going to go run Pro 2, you know, and like be a newbie.
Well, and you know, and listen, I mean, the Pro 2 class, even though it's probably one of the better ones that we've seen in a, maybe ever, but even though the skill level is higher there, there's certainly a mix of people that I don't want to say don't belong there. That's not the right terminology, but maybe, you know, when you watch an event like this where there was well more than 16 drivers that competed in Pro 2, you have to look at some of these guys and say, man, the ones that didn't qualify, there's something wrong there. And here's what I mean by this, just to, like, not to diminish anybody's talent or skill level, but you know, for you know, no, but here's the thing. Like, you look at a guy like Travis Reeder. Travis Reeder finished, you know, he competed in Pro 2 last year, first year ever. He was second. He returns back to Pro 2 this year, and again, top of the field. Like, this is not somebody that's questionable. Like, he didn't pop in for, like, he's constantly going to be dominating that series because he has the skill level. So when you see drivers come in and they struggle to qualify in Pro 2, you know, time and time and time again, it's not an accident. It just means that their skill level is not there to be able to continue to compete there. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't change. I'm not saying that, you know, there's car issues or this issues or things that impact how that works. But you get to a point where if every week you're looking at some of these drivers come in and they struggle to qualify, then they do qualify. One of the things I thought was always interesting, and we've talked about this a lot with some of the drivers in our other Formula Drift podcasts, right? Not the Formula Drift podcast, but like, you know, some FD drivers that have done some mm-hmm. of our podcasts. They talk about how, especially the ones that have made the jump from Pro 2 to Pro, and one of the things that they are very, very clear about is that the jump between Pro 2 to Pro 1 sometimes is almost easier in the sense if you have the skill level to be able to compete with those other drivers, there's a consistency that comes with being in a better field. When you're with the pro drivers, they're much more consistent to follow. You're not guessing what's going to happen in front of you. And if you looked at the Pro 2 field, you know, especially during qualifying and some of those, you know, early on top 16 battles, you watch some of those lead and chase runs. It's extremely unpredictable. If you're a really solid chase driver and you get up there and you're trying to chase a car that's all over the place, they can't hold a line. How do you trust that?
I mean, sure, but I'll make a counter argument that's really simple.
Sure.
If it's so easy to transition from Pro 2 to Pro.
Well, I understand what you mean. That's not exactly what I was like. I wasn't exactly making that point. But what I'm saying is there is something to be said about having consistent, you know, consistent drivers ahead of you that you can count on when you transition out of a smoke line and all of a sudden they're sideways in front of you versus, you know, kind of being where you think they're going to be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, let's not talk on this topic all night, but I think part of that just comes down to, I think all the pro-ams aren't created equal, right? Like
yes.
You earning your license in one place is very different than earning your license in another place.
Right.
But I mean, what can really be done at that level? You know, like, you know, should Ryan Sage be at all 72 pro-ams around the nation, making sure they're held up to a standard? Like, I don't know. I feel like these problems probably exist in most motorsports. Where you're coming up, like I'm sure every ARCA series is not the same. I'm sure all the Formula One, like, you know, Formula One generally feeds from karting. I'm sure all the karting series aren't the same.
Right.
But, you know, if you're truly dedicated to becoming a pro driver, I think that you can look at the origins of where these successful drivers have come from and probably draw some assumptions of like where you should be going to try and, you know, earn your license, so to speak.
Right. Well, especially if you want, if you're really looking at it for the longevity and the long-term, you know, competitiveness of your own program.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. I just think that if you're going to go back to the argument of trying to make Pro 2 kind of not necessarily so much of a feeder series and draw some of the bigger names or draw some of the pro level guys back into Pro 2, there, you know, having a short schedule, having a 4-event schedule, and the inconsistency of having a solid, you know, field all the way through there, it doesn't help to make the case that that would be its own series and still kind of looked at on a similar level as pro.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
Maybe.
All right. That was an extremely tangent. We just jumped off there. Point number 8, Matt Field will be a championship contender in 2019. Matt Field really seems to have ironed out his car and really has ironed out his season this year so far.
Yeah, you know, I did a little more digging after I sent out the article. Matt Field is like him being based up in NorCal. It's like he's like the Golden State Warriors, I guess, of drifting or whatever, where it's like, okay. You know, I don't know. I don't watch the NBA, so I might not be using the best analogy, but at least let me just stick with an analogy I know. In American soccer, the Seattle Sounders are a team who sucks like the first 50% of the season, and then magically right around this time of the year, they like win every game and then go on like this magnificent run. And like, that's kind of Matt Field. Like, I thought it was the Corvette, but like, when you look at his history as a driver, like, you know, he's really strong at like Texas. He's really strong at Irwindale. He's always been strong at Irwindale. And it's like, when you get to those events like Long Beach and Road Atlanta, he's nowhere to be found. You know, so, I mean, he's lost to some horrific drivers at Road Atlanta. And so I don't, you know, obviously this year you can credit some of that to the Corvette, but it would be curious to see, can he, you know, if he can overcome that like early season slump, he can be a champion. The problem is in Formula D, there's only 8 rounds. And right. So the average champion is like near or like breaking 500 points. So it's like you start doing that math. I can do that math right here on this lovely device called a telephone. But you need 500 points from 8 events. That's 62 points an event, which is basically like you need almost a top 4 per round.
Right.
Right. So if you win an event, you can afford a top 8. Basically, it's kind of how that would counterbalance. Like you can take the 100, you know, get the lower score there. But you're basically looking at you need to be a champion. You basically have to average a final 4.
Right.
So, and if you want to not average the final 4, you've got to win. I mean, look at James Dean, went out in the top 16 this weekend. Osbo won, and it went from a 89-point gap to a 30-point gap. So he's just got to figure out what to do at the beginning of the season and, like, drive like he drives at Irwindale in Long Beach, and he could realistically, you know, be in a contention for that championship next year.
I always think it'd be so interesting to be able to – you know, when we have a conversation like this, to really hear Matt Field's, his personal take on that first part of the season for himself. Because we don't have that inner part knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, sometimes, you know, you'll find out has a lot to do with a car that we don't know, or maybe it's just, you know, seat time. Or
he probably just called me an a-hole and say,
yeah,
you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. But
pretty accurate, right?
I mean, maybe I feel like I know what I'm talking about.
Right. Right. Because, you know, we're avid drifters. So, all right. So your point number 7, and I love this point, Dean Kearney rocked his top 32 battle. Dean Kearney, he certainly has a skill to be a top driver. When he's on, man, he's incredible. And he's probably one of the most exciting drivers to watch. I mean, that Viper, I know, and you even touched on it in your point, there was rumors that it was going away this season.
Yeah.
But it's a cool car to watch. And I really like that it's the only one.
It's cool. I like it. But man, he's had a really embarrassing season. I mean,
I understand.
I don't know what it is, but it's like I don't even think his car started at Long Beach. I'm trying to remember. His car didn't even start at Long Beach. In Road Atlanta, I think he did a top 16. And that's his only top 16 of the season.
I know.
Every other event, he's losing in the top 32. And I don't know what it is, but it's like, I agree. When that car's on, I really like it. But like, it's just, it hasn't been on. Like, I think this event was the first time I saw him like be the Dean Kearney we all know.
Right.
The issue is he was up against a really good driver and lost.
Well, I mean, that did go to – right, I understand he lost. I mean, he went to a one more time battle. And their first – and that first match was – it was a really – it was a good battle. He has moments of absolute – I don't want to say brilliance. It's not – it made me overplaying it a little bit. But he has moments where he clearly brings an A game, and he's an extremely exciting and talented driver. And you can see it right there.
Yeah, he's missing something this year. I don't know if there was like a mental switch off thinking he wasn't going to have to drive the Viper – and he was going to be in like a 240SX like everybody else. I don't know what
at
his
one time.
Yeah, I don't know what his car plans are, but I don't know. I feel like they got to figure something out quick for him, or he's going to just kind of fall into that like irrelevant drifter ether a little bit.
Right. Your point number six, Chelsea Denofa is the future of drifting. Denofa definitely brought his A game for St. Louis, and it was really nice to see him on the podium.
Yeah, you know, I think part of that statement, I think, even has to do with things outside of like Formula D.
Right.
I think as long as he continues to compete in Formula D and does well, I think that will be like a complementary part
of the package.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, he's really becoming a drifting ambassador, and it's what I find the most interesting. Just, I wouldn't write about this, but, you know, talking about it with you in like this analytical way, it's really interesting to me how he's really like one of the big drivers nowadays. I mean, he's got, I think, probably one of the most expensive cars in the grid. He's got one of the biggest pit areas on the grid, but somehow he still has this very like grassroots
approachable feel.
Yeah. And like, somebody else said this to me. I won't say who it was. I don't know if I can repeat their words, but they pointed something out to me that I found really interesting. They were like, you know, Chelsea Denofa is probably one of the only guys who could get busted doing something illegal. And for those listeners that don't know what happened, he was basically like gluing his tires onto the rim back when, you know, people were having a lot of debeating issues. And he got fined. I think it was Orlando. He basically was just disqualified for that event. And he was like, you know, Denofa's one of the only guys that could like get caught.
That was this year?
No. This was he was in the BMW still. So okay. 2 years ago. But he was using the anecdote of like, you know, Chelsea Denofa's like the everyday drifter hero. And he was like, could you imagine like if Frederick Osbo or like one of these other drivers got caught doing that? Like, you wouldn't hear the end of it. People would still be like complaining and, you know, moaning online and being like, oh, well, Osbo probably won because he glued his tires together. But like, it's interesting that like Denofa had that happen, and like it didn't really skip a beat with him. Like, people are just, I don't know, he has that like charisma, he has that personality where like I could see as like the, if you look in the crystal ball of drifting, I feel like he's going to become one of these like Jeremy McGrath or Valentino Rossi or like Lewis Hamilton to the sport, where like just iconic in a certain way. Like he represents the everyday drifter to a lot of guys, and he's, you know, he's very involved in the grassroots, and he does these really cool like breakdown videos on YouTube. I think his package is just, he's positioning himself to be this amazing drifter. And I think adding to that, he actually had success in St. Louis, and he did these really cool like reverse wild entries and qualifying. He's just building that kind of hype machine, I think, slowly but surely.
Well, and you know, like you mentioned, his How to Drift series on YouTube is probably one of the best and easy to, like, you literally watch it and you're like, I can do this.
Yeah, totally.
Right? He goes to a ton of grassroots events, specifically up in the Pacific Northwest. And I think that keeps him very relevant on the scene, and it allows people to feel that he's very approachable. And the truth is, like, when he's not on, you know, in an FD program, he's out there drifting in, you know, E36s and E46s and, you know, stuff that's not these big dollar cars So I think that there is something there. I think that the social presence is different, and I'm not talking about the amount of social following, because it's not like there's plenty of drivers that have 100, 200, 300,000 followers. But what I'm talking about is the amount, the people that I think are following him, I think are really embedded into the drift community. So I think his touch and his correlation kind of extend further than some of the other drivers.
Yeah, for sure.
Your point number five, St. Louis certainly, well, I'm going to synopsis this, but basically St. Louis really brought a struggle to some of these teams trying to keep their engines together. That seemed to be apparent. A lot of heat. It was a 90 degree average during the day event. So there, between the heat and I think the high speed and that they needed to maintain to be able to run this course, I think that that was probably part of why there were so many issues. But there was a number of teams that were kind of faced with engine problems.
Yeah. I mean, how hot does it get in New York? Like 65 degrees? Is that like your summer?
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just sums it up. I think there was a lot of full throttle. There was a lot of heat. As someone who's just moved to a much hotter place than he lived, it's not fun. It's not very desirable to a point. But I mean, I don't think there's too much to analyze or talk about there. It's just, you know, a combination of factors really put some teams on their behind. And, you know, some teams can keep up, some can't. There was a lot of engine swaps on Thursday. I think there was some other engine issues. I mean, James Dean had an engine issue in top 16 that basically could hinder his whole back-to-back championship.
Right. Yeah, it was messy. Point number four, fans were robbed of another Ward House battle. It just seems like it's never going to happen.
Kind of. Like, I'm almost over it at this point. It's like that overhyped movie that, like, probably would have been good if not no one told you it was going to be good. But since everyone has told you it's good, you're like, really? This is what everyone was excited about?
You wrote about it perfectly. You said, you wrote, and I wrote this down because I wanted to make sure, and I quote, these S15s are indestructible until they battle each other. It's like, that's like 100% accurate. These cars are the cars that you just, they're like the ironclad, you know what I mean? They're the Russian in, you know, in Rocky, and all of a sudden, they go against each other, and it's just a nightmare.
Yeah, no, I forgot that I wrote that. It's just very accurate. I don't know. We got two more rounds to see it happen, but I think that's one of the things that everybody's waiting for. Like, we all want to see it, and it will be really interesting based on how Texas shakes out. If Osvo can maybe, say, take the lead in Texas, it would be really great at Irwindale to see them battle. But then you also got to kind of wonder, like, would a certain one of them maybe let the other one win because there was, like, a championship on the line? I mean, it's happened before with some other people. We won't say any names. But I don't know. It's just I think that dynamic and that, like, the building of that hype, if it were to explode at, like, an Irwindale and, like, maybe Petior, like, steals the championship away from Dean or something, it's something to watch. I don't think we've finished that chapter of that story yet.
Right. Your point number three, Kengushi loves these track styles. It seems like if he can really push past the issues with the car and kind of get things together, he really is a star. I mean, he's an FDOG, right? He's been there for what? He's been there since day one.
Yeah, and I don't think he's won since Houston 2005. I mean, that's off the top of my head. If I'm wrong, Ken, I apologize. But yeah, maybe it's the car, but it's like, how long can you blame the car? Not saying that, like, Ken has something to do with it, but, like, program, I don't know. Like, there was a time period when all the 86 guys were having problems, right? And it seems like Dai has kind of, like, overcome these issues. Turk's overcome a lot of these issues. Yeah. And so why does Ken still have these issues? I don't think anybody questions that Ken's a driver that's good, but, like, do they need, I don't know, do they need new mechanics? Do they need something? Ken, I feel like, is probably one of the drivers who maybe gets some of the least amount of seat time outside of Formula D. Like, you don't see him at Just Drift or Irwindale. Yeah. I don't know. There's something missing there. I definitely think he seems, I think I mentioned it earlier in the podcast too, he really struggles at these like ovals, like these non-road course tracks. He struggles in Long Beach. And so Texas has usually been his time to shine. And now he's got Gateway, but you know, you can't just be good at one thing and be successful in Formula D. And I would hate to see one of these OGs leave the sport, but, like, I don't know. Him or his team really needs to figure out something to unlock the success that some of these other teams are having.
And it's a shame, too, because he really is a very, very talented driver.
Agreed.
Yeah. Point number two, Pro 2 Championship is in a one-point race. I mean, look, this is between Travis Reeder and Dylan Hughes. They're separated by only 1 point now. Their match in the finals was a hell of a match. I mean, it was incredible. They're both drivers that are skilled. They're both running very similar platforms. So that kind of put it at, you know, neck and neck. They're both good friends, and they're both from the Pacific Northwest. So these are homies that have been driving together since they were, you know, kind of first got into Pro-Am, maybe even before. We had Travis Reeder on, I think it's episode three of our podcast. And he basically said, one of the questions we had asked him was, you know, pick one of your favorite people to battle in Formula Drift. And his answer was Dylan Hughes. And he kind of gave the same reasons, similar cars, similar platforms, you know, driving forever, friends, yada, yada, yada. But it was interesting. It was almost kind of fun for me to watch, to have that conversation with him, you know, a few months ago, and then to watch them in the finals together. And now they're kind of 1 and 2 neck and neck for the championship.
Yeah, let's see how much Reeder likes Dylan Hughes if he beats him for the championship.
Well, I mean, he liked it now because he won against him.
Well, yeah, but, you know, let's give him 2 more rounds and see how he feels.
Then we can have him back on and we can curse Dylan Hughes out. I'm just kidding.
I agree. If only Dylan Hughes had Koenig wheels, he could have done better.
I know. Problem. Well, I don't know. I don't know about that, but I really like Dylan, and anybody who I've spoke to has had nothing but good things to say about him. So, you know, if you're listening, shout out. Give me a ring. We'll we'll see what's going on.
Is your phone number
going
to flash across the bottom of the screen?
Oh, that'd be so good.
212. No, I don't actually
think. Could you imagine?
It's like a Manhattan area code, I think. That's all I know.
Right. Well, that's what we should start doing. Your point number one, Osbo drove his way to the championship Royal Rumble. So I think really, I mean, look, he really seems to be super focused now. Nothing phases him, and you pointed that out well in your point number one. You know, people beat in his door and smack him in the quarter and this, that, and the other thing, and he just does it. It just doesn't faze him. He's a machine now. He just keeps going through with it. Doesn't bother him.
Yeah, well, I always have things I think in my head, and I always like when another driver says them, or I kind of ask a driver without trying to like produce my own bias and get the same answer. And Pat Gooden took it upon himself on Facebook, basically say like it's basically great that Frederick Osbo is not driving like a piece of shit driver anymore. I'm paraphrasing Pat Gooden.
Yeah, and I would also like to make it very clear that in no way did I say that, or did Koenig say that about.
Yeah,
that wasn't our thoughts. So
no, and so Pat Gooden also didn't say that either. I just can't exactly remember what he said. Nice. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but there was a lot of people out there, myself included, who just felt like Osbo, if he would feel contact, would spin, if he would. I don't know. He had this like very Daigo Saito thing going on where like he was always trying to like bait a driver into a mistake and kind of focus more on how do I mess this guy up more than like I can outdrive you because I'm better than you. And I don't know if it's like the change in car or like he's just matured in Formula Drift, but it just seems like he's much more committed to being a awesome driver. Like, you know, he was getting smashed left and right and he kept going. And I think that's one of the reasons why I don't think anybody questions that he's a top three driver, but it's like now he's driving like that. Like he has that confidence. Like, look, you're going to run into me. You're going to tandem really well, but I don't care. I can still beat you. And I think there was a time period where like he lacked that a little bit. And I don't know, he's a champion now. He's close to winning his second championship. He's also the most winning driver in Formula Drift. And so I think some of those factors at play probably have helped him like drive with a little bit more confidence than maybe he had before. And I think that's kind of on display at the track.
That's what happens when you are on a Stefan Papadakis program.
But he was on the Papadakis program back.
I was just kidding.
He was doing those things, and like I don't think anybody questions Steph's talents, but
not at all.
It's very clear. If you go back, I think about Wall. Go back and watch Wall from 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. And I'm going to totally make this up, but I want to say it was like a battle with Frederick and Conrad. Like Conrad, like hit his door, Like, it's very obvious. Like, Conrad came in, hit his door, you know, and honestly, it might have even been Forsberg or somebody. It literally, like, just boop, little, like, they came out of thing, and it was like a, it was like this, dunk, just like a little hit in the door. You could see the tire mark on the door, and, like, Osbo got hit and literally just shut down, just, like, steered out of drift and, like, coasted off the track. And it was like, really? Really? Like, he was like, it's not that he was doing something wrong per se, but it was like a very, like, ungentlemanlike way to, like, take a win, you right. know? Like, there's a lot of guys who, you know what, I don't blame them if they take that path, but I'm also not going to like it, and I'm probably going to talk smack on it. But honestly, if I was a Formula Drift driver, I'd probably do the same thing. I'd probably listen along, and the second somebody hit me, I'd, like, you know, let go of the wheel, or, you know, I'm very competitive. Like, I'm not above taking the easy win, but at the same time, like, you're not going to make many friends in the pits. You're probably going to get called out on the internet. And I don't know. He's just, he's like risen above that or changed his mentality. He's clearly like mentally stronger, more confident. I actually haven't even talked to him. And he's one of those people for some reason, like I never like see at the events. I also go to less events than I used to, but I don't know. Like I'm going to be in Texas now that I live in Texas, and maybe I'll try and talk to him and see how I feel he presents himself. But I don't know. He has some different swagger about him in the car for sure.
Right. Yeah. So that's it. That's we've run through the points. We have cleared St. Louis. We're moving on to Texas. Some more literal than others.
Yes, exactly.
So, all right. You have anything else you want to add to this episodic closure here?
I mean, I think watch Texas. You know, yeah. Now that I'm a shill for Formula Drift, I think you should watch the event, and I think you should read my article after the fact.
Yeah, you should.
I think St. Louis produced two great championship races with two battles left. Like we mentioned, Pro 2 is one point away. I don't think you can ask for anything better than that.
Right.
And Pro is a 30-point spread, but I mean, Frederick Osbo gets first and James Dean gets fourth even. In Texas, and all of a sudden, Osbo's leading the championship going into Irwindale. Irwindale always seems to be exciting. So, well,
and you know what, and that's a good thing. If you got to the last event and it was already kind of spelled out, and we talked about this last episode, but it wouldn't really feel that much like an exciting an event
for sure. Yeah, I mean, real quick before we go, like we produced this really really cool Irwindale tribute piece that has been getting released for a long time. For one reason or the other, it hasn't been released. Now I'm actually just kind of holding it until I know 100% sure Irwindale is like gone. But it's kind of cool, like when you, some of the memories you think of Irwindale itself, like Jared talks about some really interesting things in the tribute, like how that's the only ever time he's cussed, like during the live stream, is at Irwindale. Like it just, it tends to generate these really like, emotional and impactful events. And I get some people are jaded by the whole Irwindale's closing every year, but you know, at the end of the day, that's out of Formula Drift's control.
Right. It has nothing to do with them.
Yeah. The, you know, investors and the California government are involved. And so you can imagine, you know, for anyone living in the state of California, they can tell you how much fun it is when the government gets involved, or, you know, just ask any car manufacturer that's got to make 50 state CARB legal parts or, 49.
Ask any manufacturer. Yeah. Any, right.
Go to SEMA and ask
anybody there
how much they love the state of California's government, and you can find out about all you need to know about why Irwindale can't get demolitioned in a shopping mall built.
Right.
But I don't know. I honestly, like before St. Louis, I wasn't down on Formula Drift, but I was like, man, this is really turning out to be a dull season. James Dean's bulldozing the competition, and now that Pro 2 had another event, it came to life. I don't know. I'm very rejuvenated. I'm very excited to see Texas come up here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, Gateway turned out to be a really good pivotal point to kind of set things up for the last part of the run.
Exactly. Totally.
Yeah. I'm ready. All right. So why don't you tell people where to find you on Instagram?
It's just my name, Joey Redmond, Redmond. You can find tons of non-drifting content. And I don't even think I posted in like 3 weeks, but I'm going to work on something better for you guys.
Right. Texas content. And make sure you head over to Formula Drift's website and look at, you know, read Joey's 10 points. I think they're, you know, we talk about them. You get the in-depth, but go read what he actually has to say. I try not to go too specific and literal into it. It's worth a quick read. All right, that's a wrap. For more info on the podcast, head over to koenigwheels.com/podcast. If you've been enjoying these podcasts, please subscribe. We're on Google Play, iTunes, and the full video episodes are always on YouTube. You can catch us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at Koenig Wheels USA. That's it. We're out of here. Peace.